Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Wendy Carlisle, and this week on Background Briefing, how a very big idea has come out of the shadows. With rapid Arctic ice melts and rising emissions, scientists are now beginning to think planet Earth could be running out of time. And they've begun to talk about what's possibly the most dangerous techno-fix of all time, artificially manipulating the climate to cool the planet down. It would be the equivalent of hitting the panic button.
Now, suppose that space aliens arrived on... Maybe they're going to land at the UN headquarters down the road here, or maybe they'll pick a smarter spot. But suppose they arrive and they give you a box, and the box has two knobs. One knob is the knob for controlling global temperature. Maybe another knob is a knob for controlling CO2 concentrations. You might imagine that we would fight wars over that box because we have no way to agree about where to set the knobs. No global governance, and different people will have different places they want it set. Now, I don't think that's going to happen. It's not very likely. But we're building that box. The scientists and engineers of the world are building it piece by piece in their labs.
This is the voice of one of the world's top atmospheric scientists, Canada's Professor David Keith, speaking at a conference in California, and he's describing how bit by bit scientists are learning how to artificially control the climate in a process called climate engineering.
Even when they're doing it for other reasons, even when they're thinking they're just working on protecting the environment, they have no interest in crazy ideas like engineering the whole planet. They develop science that makes it easier and easier to do.
As a former lead author on UN climate change reports, his credentials are impeccable, but he's also a maverick. David Keith is at the forefront of a group of scientists raising what must be the most unpopular subject in science. Climate engineering is a political bombshell, and it could be highly dangerous. No one really knows. There are lots of reasons David Keith thinks climate engineering is a bad idea. But he's calling for a brutally honest debate.
And so I guess my view on this is not that I want to do it, I do not, but that we should move this out of the shadows and talk about it seriously, because sooner or later we'll be confronted with decisions about this, and it's better if we think hard about it, even if we want to think hard about reasons why we should never do it.
And on Background Briefing today, you'll hear why engineering the climate, as far out and crazy as it sounds, is now being seriously talked about by some of the world's leading scientists and thinkers. Nobel Prize-winning economist Professor Tom Schelling.
Back then, if I spoke to an audience about geoengineering, half the audience thought I was crazy and the other half thought I was dangerous. And I think scientists who spoke about it or wrote about it found that they either weren't taken seriously or they were taken too seriously and were believed to be mad scientists who wanted to try to control the climate. I think now it's become a respectable subject to talk about and write about, and I think over the coming years it's bound to receive a lot more attention.
Not all of them agree with it. In fact, there's strong opposition to climate engineering in many quarters. Not just because it might do more damage than good, but because it could trigger wars. Thinking on climate engineering has done a complete U-turn in the last 20 years. From Columbia University, Professor Wally Broker.
I used to say that if people had a list of things that they didn't want scientists to study, probably top of the list would be dependence of intelligence on race. You know, are Chinese really smarter than the rest of us? And then number two would be, you know, engineering the climate.
In the mid-1980s, he and a colleague, John Knuckles, decided to look at some modelling by a Russian scientist that suggested an overheated planet could be cooled by shooting sulphur particles into the stratosphere. And they concluded that the Russian was right. But their research was never intended to give political leaders an excuse not to act on global warming. It was meant to be a last resort.
When Knuckles and I wrote this paper, we entitled it an insurance policy against a bad CO2 trip. So we were thinking of it as a bailout, saying, well, if nothing is done and the climate becomes, by everybody's evaluation, a lot worse than it is now, then people are going to demand that we bail it out, and that's a way to do it. So we weren't proposing it as a solution to the CO2 problem. We were sort of proposing it as a way to salvage the situation if things went bad.
Their modelling was based on mimicking volcanic explosions which shot sulphur particles into the stratosphere. But it wouldn't be without aesthetic problems.
I think one of the principal side effects would be a psychological one. If we did this, we'd never have a blue sky day again because the things we added up there would bleach the sky, so it'd always be, you know, a pale blue or white, and that would be worldwide. I mean, in a sense, an end of really blue sky days, which sort of, you know, I think around here anyway, probably in Europe and places where you don't have many, they buoy people's spirits, don't they? If you have them all the time, maybe you like cloudy days, I don't know. You Aussies have, you know, a lot of blue sky days.
It's cold outside. Professor Broker told Background Briefing he thought that climate engineering was, quote, the equivalent of screwing with the atmosphere, unquote. But like many scientists, he's worried that when global warming starts to bite, the public will demand action to cool the planet.
Doubling of CO2, the models would say, is 3.5 degrees warming. I think that's going to dry out Australia like mad. You ought to be scared to death of that. You're going to really be dry. Dry, 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 dry. And, you know, that's going to cause sea level to go up and so forth. So even doubling is going to cause big changes. But if we don't get serious about it, we're going to triple or quadruple the CO2, no doubt about it. And that's going to drive us into the realm where people are going to scream, we got to cool the planet off.
But Professor Broker's paper was never published. Not because it was junk science, it wasn't, but because the scientific community decided that a bit of self-censorship was in order.
And we wrote a paper about it, and we sent it around to prominent people in the field, and they said, by all means, don't publish this. The world is not ready for it. So we just put it on the shelf.
The view was that if politicians discovered you could artificially cool the planet, they'd do nothing to cut emissions. Now, 20 years later, there's been a sea change. Instead of shutting the debate down, it's now game on. And the trigger for the debate has come from impeccable quarters. Just 2 years ago, at the end of 2006, the Nobel Prize-winning scientist Dr. Paul Crutzen, the man who received the prize for his groundbreaking work on the ozone layer, wrote an important editorial under the heading Albedo Enhancement by Stratospheric Sulphur Injections, a contribution to resolve a policy dilemma. In lay terms, it was about the possible use of technology to bounce the sun's rays off the planet to slow down the rate of warming. Some of the ideas he discussed were things like pumping sunlight-reflecting particles into the stratosphere using balloons or artillery guns. Another idea was to create little nuclear winters using soot. Professor Crutzen's essay was clearly written in anger and frustration at the lack of action to reduce emissions. He pointed out that messing with the stratosphere could blow a hole in the ozone layer and make ocean acidification even worse. But he thought climate geoengineering should be investigated because it might be the only escape route. Background Briefing sought an interview with Professor Crutzen, but he declined, telling us he'd said his piece. Here's a reading from his editorial.
Building trust between scientists and the general public would be needed to make such a large-scale climate modification acceptable. Finally, I repeat, the very best would be if emissions of the greenhouse gases could be reduced so much that the stratospheric sulphur release experiment would not need to take place. Currently, this looks like a pious wish.
Support for Professor Crutzen's provocative editorial was by no means unanimous, and like Wally Broker's experience 20 years before, he encountered substantial opposition. But this time, the science heavyweight swung in behind him. The president of America's peak science institution, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, Ralph Cicerone, wrote in defence of his stance.
I am aware that various individuals have opposed the publication of Crutzen's paper, even after peer review and revisions, for various and sincere reasons that are not wholly scientific. Here, I write in support of his call for research on geoengineering.
And that, it seems, was all it took to liberate the discussion. An off-the-record gathering of North America's top scientists and economists met at Harvard University for 2 days to discuss climate engineering. The meeting was organised by Professor David Keith, whom you heard earlier in the program. David Keith is the research chair in energy and the environment at the University of Calgary in Canada, which is where he was when Background Briefing put in a call to him.
That was an amazing fact about this meeting. So in some ways, I found that meeting personally intimidating because I was coming back to Harvard and co-organizing this meeting in front of all, you know, some of the most famous crowd in the world. That meeting really was the brain trust of a bunch of the atmospheric science community as well as some of the public policy community, like the former head of the World Bank, the president of Harvard. So a really impressive crowd of people. And at the end of the meeting, there was really an extraordinary level of agreement in the room, not every person, but an amazingly consistent level of agreement in the room that we have to take this seriously. And you might think that I would feel this is a huge personal vindication. After all, I published an early paper in the early 90s arguing that we should take geoengineering seriously. Not that we should do it, but that we should take it seriously. So you might imagine that my reaction at the end of having this meeting of these famous people at Harvard, that people finally agreed, yes, we should take it seriously, that I would feel some huge triumph. But it was the opposite. What I felt was fear.
What really shocked Professor Keith was to hear the urgency with which some of his fellow scientists were now viewing this.
Also, another stunning thing at that meeting was that there are several people who are talking about doing it quite soon. So my line has always been, we should do some research about this now and think about the politics and ethics because one day we're going to face it, 30 or 50 years from now. But several credible people in that room were saying, well, hold on, if the Arctic ice really keeps melting as fast as we've seen the last few years, and we had some geoengineering method that really seemed like it might work, albeit with some side effects, why wouldn't you begin to do a little bit of geoengineering even 10 or 20 years from now to begin to take the edge off the rate of warming?
And that surprised you and frightened you?
It surprised me a lot. And my instant reaction is that I disagreed with that. But then when you try and think logically about why exactly you wouldn't do it, it's not so clear.
Sitting in that Harvard University seminar room was Professor Scott Barrett, the director of the International Policy Program at Johns Hopkins University in Washington. And as he listened to the presentations, he imagined a ghastly perfect storm brewing, where political inaction collides with a worsening climate change forecast.
So there's almost a kind of a collision here between the world failing to address the problem in any kind of fundamental way on the one hand, and on the other hand, the problem itself being perhaps even more concerning than was thought previously. And if this continues and we continue not to address the problem in this fundamental way and the science of climate change reveals itself to be even more worrisome with every passing year, then eventually you're going to get to the point where people are going to consider using a technology like this, whether we discuss it or not. So there was a sense of really necessity, and that's really what I think was on a lot of people's minds at this meeting.
So when you went into this meeting at Harvard, I suppose, were you one of those people who thought this was really crazy science? And did you come out of that meeting thinking it still was crazy science?
No, I should say that the first time I heard of it, I thought it was crazy science. It sounded more like science fiction. It was something that we certainly didn't need to take very seriously at the time. I first heard about it around 1990 or so. And the idea of tampering with the global climate, it is the stuff of movies. It's not the sort of thing that most scientists would think about. Scientists tend to be very conservative in their thinking, and And also on the policy side, people like me were thinking very much about how to address the problem fundamentally. So I never went into this with great enthusiasm, and I deliberately neglected the topic, actually, until 2006. And I think that's true for a lot of people. I think a lot of scientists have known about it for quite a long time, but they've been working to help the world understand this challenge, and in the case of some scientists, working to promote activities that will address the problem in a fundamental way. I think virtually everyone in that room really was there because of the realization that all this effort really so far has not borne fruit.
The Harvard meeting was not the first top-level scientific gathering convened in the wake of Professor Paul Crutzen's editorial. A previous meeting at NASA in California brought together another gathering of scientists. Amongst the invitees was Professor Jim Fleming, a historian of weather and climate control.
I was invited as a historian working in the field and writing about this, and we went to the NASA Ames campus, which is at the south end of San Francisco Bay, and it was a gated, it was relatively secure base in which they do some classified experiments, and so we had to come in and show our identifications, and I remember the press was waiting there wondering if they could get in, and it was a behind-the-scenes kind of meeting.
Professor Fleming told the scientists that efforts to control the weather were not new.
And that others had said it was okay to think about climate engineering. One of the most prominent others was John Fitzgerald Kennedy in 1962, who had called on the Soviets and the Americans and, in fact, all nations of the world to work together on peaceful uses of outer space and peaceful ways that they could cooperate in weather programs, including climate studies and, as he put it, large-scale weather control. And so I said this field has a very long history. It's not always the most dignified history. It's really quite what I call checkered history. But it does go back, in the U.S. case, at least to the 1830s.
Jim Fleming had never met any of the people who attended, but one person he did know by reputation was Dr. Lowell Wood, a charismatic and controversial figure.
The others were unknown to me before that time, but people like Lowell Wood, who is a very prominent defense intellectual, protege of Edward Teller. Teller was the father of the H-bomb. And Wood was very much engaged in SDI kind of Star Wars defense projects here in the United States and was now advocating putting up sunscreens to shade the planet in case the CO2 warming gets out of hand. And Wood's a cultural icon, formerly with the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories. And you would imagine if there is going to be a global thermostat, some people were assuming it might be built there, the temperature of the world might be adjusted there. It's a very centrally controlled kind of vision. He talked in his presentation about futuristic hardware, sort of stratospheric, gigantic military balloons on which you could hang hoses to pump sulfates into the stratosphere. He is very sure of himself. He was very clear to the meteorologists that were in the group that their expertise wasn't really relevant to this topic. It was, in his terms, it was all physics. He says, I understand the radiation budget, and I know how to attenuate these sunbeams. And so I got an impression of him as a very self-assured, but in a sense likable fellow who was an icon of that era of SDI.
About a year ago, Rolling Stone magazine ran a feature profile on Dr. Lowell Wood, who they called Dr. Evil. The story was about his ideas on engineering the climate, and the story was called Can Dr. Evil Save the World? Here's a reading.
In scientific circles, Wood is a dark star. As a physicist at Lawrence Livermore National Lab in California for more than four decades, Wood has long been one of the Pentagon's top weaponeers, the agency's go-to guru for threat assessment and weapons development. Wood is infamous for championing fringe science, from X-ray lasers to cold fusion nuclear reactors, as well as for his long affiliation with the Hoover Institution, a right-wing think tank on the Stanford campus. Everyone knew Wood's reputation. To some, he was a brilliant outside-the-box thinker. To others, he was the embodiment of big science gone awry.
Background Briefing requested an interview with Dr. Wood, but he declined with the following correspondence.
I've taken a vow of silence after the Rolling Stone adventure. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me.
In another email, Background Briefing told Dr. Wood that we wanted to address some of the claims floating around that the Pentagon might be interested in funding research into climate control as a tool of war. And we asked Dr. Wood if this was the case. Here's a reading.
No, the Pentagon has nothing whatsoever to do with this research, to the best of my knowledge. Why in the world would they? And no, I've never taken any money or any other form of support from the energy, fuels, industry, etc., etc. I've also executed no contracts of any kind with the devil, nor do I intend to do so.
Lowell Wood recommended we speak to his colleague, Dr. Ken Calderia, whom he's worked with in modelling climate engineering options. Ken Calderia is the senior scientist at the Carnegie Institute for Science at Stanford University, and he's just about the only scientist working on this full time. Because most of the work on climate engineering is back-of-the-envelope stuff by scientists dabbling in their spare time. But Calderia is on a mission to make it a research priority for the US government. But it's clear that when you talk to him, he's sickened at the prospect of the world resorting to climate engineering. But he can see it coming. Ken Calderia spoke to Background Briefing on a studio hookup from California.
Yeah, I think that the fact that these ideas largely came out of the weaponeers and the nuclear weapons experts gave this sort of a dirty or immoral kind of feel to it, that it was something that was the domain of people who were ready to incinerate cities and not the sort of thing that, you know, people who are worried about polar bears and ice sheets should really entertain. And so I think it was seen as the idea of sort of crazy weaponeers and not the domain of sober scientists.
The crazy weaponeers that Dr. Calderia is referring to include not only Dr. Lowell Wood, but Edward Teller, the father of the H-bomb. Edward Teller believed that technology would save humans from themselves. It was this kind of thinking that drove him to work on the H-bomb and ultimately on engineering the climate. Edward Teller.
I myself was interested in theoretical physics, in explaining atoms, molecular vibrations, knowledge and more knowledge. I didn't want to do it. But then, Hitler not only swallowed up half of Poland, he invaded the West. And 2 days later, there was an invitation to a Pan-American Congress, where Roosevelt, whom I have never seen before, was going to speak. And he made a remarkable speech, how the world is really endangered by Hitler. Among other things, and at the climax, he said, you scientists are blamed for the weapons to be used. But I tell you that if you now won't work on weapons, the freedom of the world will be lost.
Yes, Edward Teller was optimistic about technology and pessimistic about human nature. For example, after the atomic bomb was used in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he thought, well, humans will never, through their nature, avoid using these weapons again. And so what we need to do is to create a technology that would make these weapons unusable. And so his idea was to make the super bomb, which was later called the hydrogen bomb. And the idea was that this was a weapon so terrible that nobody could imagine a war like this, and so nobody would use it, regular atomic bombs. And by the early 1980s, the idea of a first strike nuclear war between Russia and the United States became thinkable. So then he said, oh, well, we better make the Star Wars missile defense system, that we can't trust treaties to prevent nuclear war, but we can create a technology that will shield us from incoming ballistic missiles. And so they talked to Ronald Reagan and got funding for the Star Wars missile defense program.
It was after the Star Wars adventure that Edward Teller and Lowell Wood turned their attention to global warming.
And again, he thought, well, we can't rely on fallible humans to reduce their carbon dioxide emissions because humans are basically a selfish, corrupt organism and will never cooperate on a global scale to achieve anything. But we could do a number of things to counteract the climate effects of greenhouse gases. And so one of his colleagues, James Early, suggested that we could put satellites in space between the Earth and the Sun, maybe a million miles out in space, that would deflect sunlight away from the Earth. They also looked at designer particles that, instead of just blocking the bulk of solar radiation the way sulfur might do, could just deflect the ultraviolet radiation, or primarily ultraviolet radiation. And since ultraviolet radiation causes skin cancer and damages crops, they were saying, well, not only are we going to solve the climate problem, but we're going to improve crop yields and we're going to reduce skin cancer. And so it would be immoral not to do this kind of engineering of the planet. And so this is really the most extreme view, that saying that we're not just engineering the planet to alleviate some of the negative effects of our actions, but we could engineer the planet to make it a better place to live.
Dr. Ken Calderia. But Professor Jim Fleming says the military has historically been interested in exploiting technological advances in weather control.
The U.S. military has always been interested in controlling the weather, so it's not simply the modern Pentagon. And even one Strategic Air Command general was quoted as saying in the 1950s, if you control the weather, you can control the world.
Well, that's the sort of...
I think this interest has continued.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if you could talk more about that, because you do see a real resonance between the weaponeers and the climate engineers, don't you?
Well, I think the technology is potentially so powerful that once people begin to think that they can master it, the military has resources that private scientific labs or university-scale laboratories simply don't have. And so once an enthusiastic person, for example, one of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or the Secretary of Defense begins to be convinced about this, they can throw vast resources at it. Some of it can be justified. During the Cold War, there was an attempt to make it rain on demand. It was thought that we could have such precise forecasts using computers that we could deploy field troops out ahead of the storms to sort of divert them, to possibly calm the waters when a hurricane's coming on shore. And then in the Vietnam era, the Pentagon was secretly seeding the clouds over the Ho Chi Minh Trail, trying to make it rain and make mud on the trail to reduce the trafficability.
It's Jim Fleming's view that climate engineering could be used as a weapon.
I think it could, if push came to shove. I've discovered there's just a tip of the iceberg showing on defense intellectuals' interest in this, because they're seeing climate change as a national security issue. It's not simply cast in vague apocalyptic terms. It's actually threats to their warfighting capability, to national security. And when you see this tip, you must assume that there's more going on that's not being reported.
And that present-day military hardware, guns and artillery, could be retrofitted and used to launch weather-changing particles into the stratosphere.
Well, there's comments like the original 1992 National Academy study had concluded that it was simpler to shoot sulfates into the stratosphere using naval guns than it would be to sequester or reduce carbon dioxide in our environment. And when I mentioned this to one of the participants, he had been one of the chairs of that National Academy study and a former Navy official. He said, sure, we've got the Navy guns. We still have them in mothballs. All we need to do is put liners in them, and we can be shooting sulfates very soon. These are huge naval guns that would lob in the military sense, they were declaring war on the stratosphere by shooting sulfates up there to make it more reflective.
During his time at the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, Ken Calderia says he's been in a meeting to discuss the idea of manipulating the weather for war, but he doesn't think it's a realistic option.
I used to work at Lawrence Livermore National Lab, which is basically the lab that created the hydrogen bomb, and one of the strange things that occurs when you work in such a place is you find yourself in odd meetings. And one meeting was this question of, are there ways to use the weather or geophysical systems as a weapon? And it turns out that it's much easier just to drop a bomb on people or do something much more direct than toy with the weather and try to get them through some weather manipulation. And so I really don't think that weather manipulation as a military weapon is a realistic concern. I do think that climate engineering could provoke wars and result in military actions.
And that's the heart of the problem. It's not that climate engineering could become a weapon of war, but it could be the reason for wars to begin. For instance, what might happen if Russia or China or Canada decided that a few degrees of extra warmth was good, but Australia found this same temperature rise caused water shortages and crop failure? Whose priorities would prevail then? Professor Scott Barrett.
The difficulty, I think, here is that as one country acts, other countries will be affected. Now, they may be affected positively, but there's also the possibility that they would be affected negatively. And you really have the prospect here with this technology of individual countries essentially having their fingers on the global thermostat. And that's why there's this question, who decides? It's not the same question we've been grappling with about how much to reduce and which country should cut back by how much when. This is much more, what should the temperature be? And different countries, of course, will be affected by climate change in different kinds of ways, and they may have very different views about this. The technology also has the potential of allowing manipulation of the climate in different directions. So you actually can even entertain the scenario that one country may want to use geoengineering to offset warming, to cool the planet somewhat against this background of warming, and other countries might want to do the opposite. And so there will be the prospect, the potential for conflict because of this new technology and the collision, really, with this environmental challenge and our inability so far to address it fundamentally.
It's these issues that are now occupying minds at the Washington think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations. They've convened a meeting to discuss what they've termed a most unusual topic, unilateral planetary-scale geoengineering. Those on the council think it's time that the policy community started seriously thinking about what might happen if climate engineering was deployed. Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, Professor David Victor.
The meeting that we're calling is particularly focused on how to manage the risk that countries will go off and unilaterally start engineering the climate. And that's the really difficult aspect of this question, because if a country decides that it very strongly in its own merits wants to do something about this, it'll find that it isn't that expensive and there isn't a lot of law or expectations to guide its behavior right now.
In fact, David Victor says climate engineering effectively means that the geopolitics of climate change are turned upside down.
When you're trying to control emissions, the only way to be effective is to get almost all the world's emitters together and get them to agree to undertake measures that could be expensive to control their emissions. And every country has a strong incentive to defect, to free ride on the efforts of other countries. And this is what makes the climate change problem politically such a difficult issue to deal with at the international level. Geoengineering is exactly the opposite. One country or a few countries could get together and decide on their own to go out and intervene in the atmosphere to offset some of the effects of climate change and maybe to intervene in ways that are beneficial to themselves. So high-latitude countries that are worried about the loss of their ice cover might intervene to block some of the sunlight and help their ice recover. And that could be beneficial for them, but it could be harmful to other nations on Earth. And so it's this complete turning upside down of the politics that I think will come to be the big political issue in the geoengineering debate.
You're listening to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National with me, Wendy Carlisle, and a program about climate engineering. 30 of America's leading scientists and thinkers, including some of the people you've heard on this program, Professor Scott Barrett, Wally Broker, David Keith, Tom Schelling, and Paul Crutzen, wrote an open letter to US presidential candidates. They urged them to fund a $30 billion clean energy research project with the vigour of the moon mission, as conceived by President John F. Kennedy in 1961.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win.
The scientists who signed the letter said they believed that private investment and the market alone was insufficient to drive the research needed in the limited time available. They said it needed to be funded by government. Back in 1961, President Kennedy recognised that to put a man on the moon would need vision, commitment, leadership and money. What these scientists want is another Apollo effort.
But if I were to say, my fellow citizens, that we shall send to the moon 240,000 miles away from the control station in Houston a giant rocket more than 300 feet tall, the length of this football field, made of new metal alloys, some of which have not yet been invented, capable of standing heat and stresses several times more than have ever been experienced, fitted together with a precision better than the finest watch, carrying all the equipment needed for propulsion, guidance, control, communications, food, and survival on an untried mission to an unknown celestial body, and then return it safely to Earth, re-entering the atmosphere at speeds of over 25,000 miles per hour, causing heat about half that on the temperature of the sun, almost as hot as it is here today, and do all this, and do all this, and do it right, and do it first. Before this decade is out, then we must be bold. Doing all the work, so we just want you to stay cool for a minute.
Without a love of my own, blue moon, you saw me standing alone.
Yeah, President Kennedy was an extraordinary president because he showed real leadership. He made the country think about itself and its role in the world in a different way.
One of the other things I found extraordinary about President Kennedy's speech was he talks about this grand idea of putting a man on the moon, and he doesn't know how it's going to be done. In fact, he says in his speech that all this money will be thrown at it and we will invent alloys that we don't know about yet. We will invent energy systems we don't know about yet. So there was no kind of the known knowns there. He was talking about the known unknowns.
You know, that's exactly why we need basic research. That's exactly right. And when you contemplate the magnitude of this challenge, the idea that you're going to do it with just things that are on the shelf and so on, I mean, to some extent, yes, we can take action using those existing technologies, but to really address it fundamentally, we're going to need to have this incredible transformation. And what you just said really explains why the science is needed and why basic research is needed, because you'll need to uncover things that we haven't contemplated. And that's what basic science and research does.
Professor Scott Barrett. In 2005, the economist Professor Tom Schelling received the Nobel Prize for his work on game theory. It's a branch of economics which describes how rational actors behave in a given set of circumstances. It's all about strategic behaviour. Professor Schelling was the brains behind the thinking on nuclear deterrence during the Cold War. In the 1980s, he got involved with the global warming debate during the Carter administration, and he's still involved. He doesn't think global attempts to reduce emissions through treaties or trading will work. He thinks the developed world should show it's serious about climate change by massively investing in new technology, just like the moon mission. But if that doesn't work, he thinks climate engineering could prove irresistible.
If geoengineering should work, and we don't know whether it will, we don't know what the side effects might be, but it really transforms the problem from one of regulating the behavior of 7 or 8 billion people in the way they cook their food and transport themselves and warm and cool themselves and all of that. And instead of having to change lifestyles and behavior of billions of people, it simply turns off the global warming, and that's bound to be very tempting. And I think what is going to be needed is for some small-scale reversible experiments to find out just how well some of these ideas work and what some of the side effects may be that we have to worry about.
And would you be able to gauge for me what you think is amongst the mainstream climate scientist community, what their attitude is towards this now? Do they now believe, do you think, that this needs to be talked about? They've stopped self-censoring themselves, in other words?
I don't think we're there yet, but I think we're going to be there in a few more years. I think the argument in favor of at least testing some of the ideas about geoengineering on a small scale without any long-term commitment yet until we've discovered how it works and where it works and whether there are serious disadvantages, I think gradually this is going to become a subject that eventually will be on the editorial pages of newspapers in Australia or the USA or the UK or Germany and such places.
Professor Schelling believes climate engineering is going to be a much more attractive option to wealthy nations than trying to reduce their emissions. And that's the problem. It's cheap and unilateral. Nations, he says, will act in their own self-interest. And he says under this scenario, conflict is inevitable.
Ordinarily, we think that the problem is going to be to get all the nations together to cooperate at the substantial sacrifice. On the other hand, if geoengineering turns out to be as effective and as cheap as some people think it will be, then the question is, how many nations will there be, any one of which could afford to undertake its own geoengineering, leaving all the other nations to enjoy or suffer the consequences? So that if it turns out that the Chinese decide they can afford to engage in geoengineering and other nations don't like it, how do we arrive at a compromise? I think that's likely to be a matter of real dispute, especially if some people think that we want to reduce global atmospheric change in temperature by 1 degree Celsius and others think we ought to do it by 4 degrees Celsius. There's a lot of room for dispute there. I think we ought to recognize that geoengineering may prove to be a too attractive solution to the problem, too attractive to some nations that foresee that they themselves are going to suffer very seriously while other nations would rather not take the risk.
So how does the world go about governing who should set the global thermostat? I mean, how do we do that?
I don't think you can prevent the conflict. I think you have to recognize that with respect to geoengineering, there is almost certain to be a conflict over exactly what to do and how much to do and who should pay for it. So I think reaching agreement on how much geoengineering to engage in, especially if it turns out that there are risks that we haven't yet identified with geoengineering that might appear more dangerous to some countries than others.
The idea of controlling the climate through direct intervention has been around for a long time, but it's true to say it's come a long way in a very short time, out of the realm of science fiction and into the science lab. But the great dilemmas are no closer to being solved. How do you prevent climate engineering from happening once countries discover it could be doable and cheap? And even then, no one can be sure that the climate engineering option won't cause an environmental disaster. As Professor David Keith stood in front of a spellbound audience of scientists at Harvard University, he laid out what has become a truly awful set of possibilities, that the more we engage in climate engineering, the more we walk away from our existing climate.
So here's one way to think about it, which is that we just do this instead of cutting emissions because it's cheaper. I guess the thing I haven't said about this is it is absurdly cheap. It's conceivable that, say, using the sulfates method or this method I've come up with, you could create an ice age at a cost of 0.001% of GDP. It's very cheap. We have a lot of leverage. It's not a good idea, but it's just important. I tell you how big the lever is. The lever is that big. And that calculation isn't much in dispute. You might argue about the sanity of it, but the leverage is real. But here's a case which is harder to reject. Let's say that we don't do geoengineering. We do what we ought to do, which is get serious about cutting emissions. But we don't really know how quickly we have to cut them. There's a lot of uncertainty about exactly how much climate change is too much. So let's say that we work hard and we actually don't just tap the brakes, but we step hard on the brakes and really reduce emissions and eventually reduce concentrations. And maybe someday, like 2075, October 23rd, we finally reach that glorious day where concentrations have peaked and are rolling down the other side. And we have global celebrations and we've actually started to, you know, we've seen the worst of it. But maybe on that day, we also find that the Greenland ice sheet is really melting unacceptably fast, fast enough to put meters of sea level on the oceans in the next 100 years and remove some of the biggest cities from the map. That's an absolutely possible scenario. We might decide at that point that even though geoengineering was uncertain and morally unhappy, that it's a lot better than not geoengineering. And that's a very different way to look at the problem. It's using this as risk control, not instead of action. It's saying that you do some geoengineering for a little while to take the worst of the heat off, not that you use it as a substitute for action. But there is a problem with that view. And the problem is the following. Knowledge that geoengineering is possible makes the climate impacts look less fearsome, and that makes a weaker commitment to cutting emissions today. This is what economists call a moral hazard. And that's one of the fundamental reasons that this problem is so hard to talk about. And in general, I think it's the underlying reason that it's been politically unacceptable to talk about this. But you don't make good policy by hiding things in a drawer.
Background Briefing's executive producer is Chris Bullock. Coordinating producer, Linda McGuinness. Research, Anna Whitfeld. And technical production this week, Mark Don. I'm Wendy Carlisle, and you're listening to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.